Welcome to the Running Explained podcast. I'm Elizabeth, a marathoner, running coach, and answer seeker. When I became a new runner at the age of 29, I had so many questions, but it felt like I was on my own to figure out all of the answers. So now I'm here to answer all your running questions to help make you a better, smarter, faster runner. There's no question too simple and no topic too complex. So let's get started. My guest this week is Dr. Adrian Chavez. Dr. Chavez is a nutrition professional. He has a PhD in nutrition. He also has a master's in exercise scientist. And you can see where the intersection comes into play. This episode is a little bit different because we're not specifically talking about running in it. I mean, yes, the things we talk about will apply to endurance athletes, but this is not an episode about running nutrition. My conversation today with Dr. Chavez is about what he calls himself as an anti-biohacker. We're talking about biohacking and why he believes, and his mission is to be an anti-biohacker, and what, and it's just a discussion about, I mean, it is nutrition focused, but kind of all the things, the marketing around certain ways that we've been taught about certain things, and it's just a really good conversation. So I hope you enjoy. Dr. Adrian Chavez, welcome to the show. I'm excited to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So before we get started in talking about biohacking, go ahead and tell us about yourself. Who are you?
So I do a lot of things right now. I currently wear a lot of hats, but I operate a business in nutrition and health promotion. So I have a PhD in nutrition and health promotion. I got that from Arizona State University in 2015. After that, I went into academia for a little bit, but just saw some opportunities outside of academia, online with social media and digital marketing, and being able to work with a larger, you know, population of people, or impact a larger population of people. So I've been doing that for about 6 years now. Been working with groups and working one-on-one, and just seen a lot of different cases and worked with a lot of different populations of individuals. During my PhD, I did research teaching classes, nutrition classes for low-income populations. So I was in community centers teaching mostly Hispanic, mostly non-English speaking individuals, you know, nutrition classes. We were taking them through exercise, like training programs, and doing like a disease prevention program. So that's always been my area of expertise and area of work, is nutrition, disease prevention. But when I got online, I realized that there was just a complete, there's just so much misinformation in the online space. So I got online, you know, trying to educate, talking about different topics, and talking about science, and talking, like, mainly just focusing on, you know, different scientific topics. And then I realized very quickly, you know, people would come to me and reach out to me with all of this different confusion. And I would have people on my post saying, oh, well, so-and-so said this. So I realized I had to start shifting the message a little bit to start helping people to understand why a lot of this stuff is misinformation. A lot of this is coming from people who often don't have backgrounds in nutrition, who often have never even worked with a human being. They're just really good marketers. They're really good at using very compelling language to get you to believe it, to get you a little bit afraid so that you pay attention to it. And so that's something that I've spent the last couple of years just trying to highlight more and help people to understand, because in the nutrition space online, there's just, I mean, it's 95% just people giving their opinion. And then there's a few people out there really trying to do a good job. And I'm sure the same is the case in your field as well. But, you know, nutrition people seem to be so confused. And before I would talk about this stuff on my platform, I would work with people, and the first couple of sessions would be like, talking to them about why all of these things are untrue, like why you can eat before noon and it's not going to, or like you can eat after six and it's not going to cause you to store fat, or you don't have to intermittent fast, or you don't have to cut carbs. And I would spend so much time with people just breaking down these simple, completely wrong myths that people get exposed to over and over again on the most popular platforms, which is the unfortunate part of it, because it's the news, it's the media, it's the the 1 million plus accounts on social media, the really massive accounts that really tend to spread a lot of this information. And it's because attention is the currency with media. Attention is the currency, and if you're trying to gain as much of that currency as possible, you're going to do sensationalist stuff in order to get the attention. That's how, I mean, that's how the marketing works with that, unfortunately.
And I always say, and this is, if anybody's listened to the show before, you'll understand this is the reason that you're here is like, oh, okay, some of the stuff he's saying, I think I've heard before. We talk a lot about, you know, general wellness, and not in like the catchword phrase, but just be like, are you taking care of your basic health? And yes, we do on this podcast, you know, we're runners and we want to run well, we want to run fast. But if you're not taking care of your basic health, if you're not eating enough, period, if you're not sleeping enough, period, you know, the rest of it isn't really going to matter. And I love what you're saying about this, you know, the fear, kind of the fear tactics and the clicks and the content and the, you know, people going viral on this stuff. Because we're talking today about biohacking. You call yourself an anti-biohacker. And I think that when we talk about things that are biohacks, first we'll define what it is, and it's a kind of a broad category of things. But the idea that you can just do this one simple trick to solve all your problems has kind of been around since the beginning of just humanity, right? We're always looking for that shortcut. We're always looking for the simple way.
Yeah, yeah. And we're always things that sound interesting, we're curious about. So when you hear biohack, you're like, wow, what does that mean? That sounds very interesting. And normally when we think about something being hacked, that's not a good thing necessarily. Like, you don't want your biology to get hacked, for example. Like, I think that's the thing that gets to me, is like, this, it's a marketing term that doesn't really mean anything, and it's been used historically to sell various different types of things that don't have any evidence behind them. So it's not a healthy habit, it's a biohack because doesn't have any science behind it, really, or maybe like some crazy theory behind it. Like, for example, the very first biohacking came from, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, like, history, but biohacking, that term, was like coined by Dave Asprey, who started like Bulletproof Coffee, who basically,
which is butter in coffee. Yeah. That's his whole thing. It was putting butter in coffee.
He convinced people that putting butter in coffee was going to accelerate fat burn, like it was going to improve cognitive function. And this is just completely made up. And it the first time I came across this, I was at an event, and there was a Bulletproof like team there, like giving out samples of buttery coffee. And I was like, why are y'all putting butter in coffee? And this was like right after I finished my PhD, and they were like, oh, it improves cognitive function and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, hold, like that was the point in time when I got online and realized what was going on online. Like, because I didn't use Instagram. Like, when you're doing a PhD, you're doing research. Like, I wasn't on Instagram, wasn't on social media, wasn't listening to podcasts. I wasn't doing any of that. I was, you're just reading tons of papers, you know, every single week. You don't have time for that other stuff. And that's what, like, caused me to recognize, like, some of the misinformation. I looked up the Bulletproof Coffee, and I'm like, man, this guy's just like making a lot of money and reaching a lot of people, telling them that butter is going to accelerate fat loss. And it progressed from there to where biohacks started, you know, people started to call everything a biohack because they realized like that term is really attractive. Marketing terms, a lot of times, a lot of these things, they get really popular, like inflammation right now. You hear inflammation all the time. It's just a term that someone used, they realized how popular it was, how attention grabbing it was, and then a lot of people use it completely in a misleading way in order to get that attention. So the biohacking thing, I mean, right now, the number of things that would be considered, you know, the blue light blockers all day, you know, there's so many different little, people were using like grounding pads at one point, where they were sleeping with like buying a $500 pad to put under their bed for like grounding purposes that they thought were going to reduce inflammation. Like, all of these different things are what I would consider biohacks. And the reality is that the vast majority of people if we look at the statistics in the United States, less than 10% are consistently aerobically active, less than 10% are consistently lifting weights, less than, you know, the majority are getting the right amount of sleep. People are watching 5 hours of television. they're sedentary the vast majority of the day. Fruit and vegetable consumption is extremely low, under one serving per day on average in the United States. Processed food is 60% of the total diet. Like, these are the things that matter, that we really need to focus on changing. And these are the things that get lost in the discussion when biohacking becomes a central, conversation, when people are talking about cold plunges and saunas. And there's, for some of these things, there may be benefits in certain circumstances. Like, for example, if you're running a marathon and you're trying to go run the next day, like, a cold exposure is probably necessary to get some of that inflammation down to recover that quickly. But if you're just an average person, living a life, you run a couple miles a few times a week, you don't need a $1,500 cold plunge to put in your backyard to be healthy. Like, you can be perfectly fine without that, and the health benefits of that they're overstated. Like, right now, when people are promoting cold plunges from a health standpoint, like, all of those claims are not really supported by any data. There's not any evidence to support the value of cold plunges. That's just another biohack. Another one that was really popular that kind of faded out, that I think is a good example, CBD. Like, CBD was the solution to everything a couple of years ago, and that just disappeared. And I, not completely, there's still a little bit of that, but like, it was everywhere. A couple years later, it's almost nowhere. And this is kind of what happens with some of these biohacks, is people try it, they spend their $100 a month on CBD. At first, they want it to work, so they believe it works. And then over time, they're like, I don't know if this $100 a month is really worth it. And then that fades away, and then collagen comes into the scene, or whatever's next. And there's some value to collagen. I just did, or I'm doing a podcast on that soon. But we also, like, we just have to understand that there's value in some of these things, but we have to get the important pieces in place first. If you're not sleeping 7 hours per day and not getting pretty quality sleep, like, that needs to be the focus. If you're not hydrated well enough, that needs to be the focus. And most people, because I've worked with over 1,000 people at this point, most people aren't doing those things. And then they're thinking about these other things. They're like, do I need a greens powder? Do I need to do this? Do I need to do that? And they're not doing the important things. And that's, that experience, I think, is a part that has shifted my message as well. Is like, I've just worked with so many people at this point that I've realized, like, oh, wow, people are really confused in chasing after every little potential hack or supplement or gimmick, and they're just missing the important stuff. Like, if we just get consistent with aerobic exercise a couple times a week, lifting weights a couple times a week, focusing on sleep, moving throughout the day and not being sedentary all day as much as we possibly can, you know, these important factors that have mounds of data to demonstrate their health benefits, if we focus on those things, then that's going to take up most of our bandwidth for most of us. Like, just really getting consistent with those things and not having to do all this other stuff. If you like that other stuff and it's convenient for you and it's accessible, great. But a lot of people are feeling like they have to go do the cold plunge, and they have to now do the sauna, and they have to now get the Theragun, and they have to do this and that. And those things oftentimes just overcomplicate a lifestyle and make it unsustainable. And at the end of the day, we have to do this forever. Like, if your goal is to run forever, like, you have to do it in a way that's going to be sustainable for you. And with your nutrition, it has to be sustainable, because your body doesn't just go away one day. Well, it does, but that's at that point where it's not something we have to worry about as much anymore.
I love your point about a lot of these things, and it is a spectrum. Like, there are practices, suggestions, recommendations that may hold some benefits for a certain segment of the population in certain circumstances. Like, we're not denying that. We're not saying that, like, every quote unquote fad biohack you hear is complete bullshit, right? For some people, cryotherapy in certain circumstances in a certain dose might actually be helpful for them. But then there are some of these things, and I want to talk specifically more about some of the nutritional fads, because I know that's your wheelhouse, and I know it's where a lot of people get really kind of confused on this, that don't have any evidence behind them or have extremely limited kind of sketchy evidence behind them. And as somebody who, and I've talked about this on previous podcasts, you know, back in the mid, you know, teens, like 7 years ago, you know, I was really all in on keto. Like, I thought it was the next big thing. I thought that I discovered, and I think this is how a lot of people feel, I discovered something that nobody else was talking about. And it made me feel like I was kind of in this exclusive club of like, ooh, I know this, but nobody else does. And never mind the fact that, you know, the evidence wasn't really supporting it, but the stuff that I was reading says that it was, and et cetera, et cetera. I feel that's how a lot of misinformation is spread, and the do your own research, quote unquote, people. But then it is this very seductive place to be in when you think I'm doing something, I'm discovering something that even the smartest people in the world haven't figured out yet. Like, I think we have to acknowledge the emotional draw to how people, that makes people feel good.
Yeah, yeah. But you also, I mean, anytime you get in that situation, you have to be humble and realize, like, or just really think, like, is this true? Like, is this really something that the smartest people in the world haven't figured out? Because you're saying 7 years ago, I started my PhD in 2011, finished in 2015. I was reading tons of research on ketogenic diets. Like I read hundreds of papers on ketogenic diets before it got that popular. In the scientific community, it was well understood, well established. We all talked about it, like, in the scientific community. The problem is that a lot of these scientists they don't have the time to communicate with the public, and they're not good at speaking in a way that the average person can understand, because they're only communicating with other scientists and other PhDs most of the time. But the reality is, like, in terms of these things, like, that is a draw. That's part of, like, the emotional draw with certain things, but you're never just going to be in front of, like, all of the smartest people in the world. There's always going to be, you know, people have learned about it and understood it. And if it seems like, oh, well, I'm on the cutting edge, or, and this is something that the smartest people don't know, it's always good to check the other side in those cases. And really, cause science doesn't change like that. Like, the studies on ketogenic diets have been published for decades now, you know, and so when something pops up very quickly like that, it's not that the science just completely changed and made this something that scientists are now aware of, or some small group of people are now aware of. It's someone figured out a really good marketing angle for this specific thing. So with the ketogenic diet, they basically just turned the Atkins diet into a new way of branding it. So, and it works, because if you avoid all of a certain macronutrient group, you're going to most likely experience improvements, and you're going to lose weight, and you're going to have some positive metabolic improvements as well, because you're forcing your body to metabolize fat. So you're forcing a little bit more of those metabolic activities to upregulate themselves. So there is some, you know, some benefit to those type of extreme approaches, but they're just not, they pop up and they go away. And those fads have been going on since the 60s. They're going to keep going on. But at this point, we have a really good foundation of knowledge to say, okay, this is generally what people need to be eating. There are exceptions to everything. There are cases where some people do better on low carb. There's cases where some people might need to avoid gluten, But generally speaking, we have a pretty good evidence base to say, okay, eat a lot of plants, you know, eat the right amount of calories, eat plenty of protein, especially for recovery. And if you're an athlete and those type of things, fuel with plenty of carbohydrates if you're running a lot. And you can go keto, but there's just, there's no evidence that it's like, this is what you have to do, which is a beautiful thing. I think some people want to be told what to do, but I think it's nice to know that there's a wide variety of diets that people can thrive off of. That's one of the things that has, that my eyes have been open to more out, being outside of like the research environment. You in research, you know, you're looking at very specific diets and things like that, and you don't really see the vast majority of different responses that people have. Where when you're working with so many people, I've met people who are completely carnivore and they feel great off of it, and people who are completely vegan and they feel great off of it. And that's pretty amazing to me that the human body can. And I know people that eat nothing but McDonald's and they feel pretty good. You know, that's incredible that the human body can just like adapt to so many different approaches. But there, I think the important thing is really understanding, okay, these are the important foundational needs. These are principles from a diet perspective that are important. But and then, you know, having flexibility from there to say, you know, do whatever works according to your own preferences, your own needs, your own, you know, what you have access to, your cultural, you know, traditions and things like that. Because these things all need to be taken into account if you're going to be eating this way forever.
As a running coach, I am often asked about supplements. Should I take this supplement? Should I take that supplement? And my answer is always, I'm not a dietitian. But my second answer is, before you start taking any supplements, you need to go get your blood work done to understand if that supplement is even appropriate for you. Because you can take supplements and not need them. And in some cases, like if you listen to the episode on iron for runners, taking a supplement that you don't need can actually be dangerous. Yes, it is possible to take too much of certain things and actually end up in not a really great place. Enter Inside Tracker. Before you start popping that iron supplement, do you actually know if your iron is low? It might be too high. Yes, it is a thing. With Inside Tracker, you can analyze your blood, DNA, and fitness tracking data to identify where you're optimized and where you're not. And now, for a limited time, get 20% off the entire Inside Tracker store by visiting insidetracker.com/runningexplained. That's 20% off the entire store, insidetracker.com/runningexplained. Something I get a lot of questions about, or I guess the questions are asked to me in this context about various habits, biohacks, shortcuts, you know, recommendations, is that for people who are acutely aware that they're not meeting their foundational needs in a category, right? I know I cannot get enough sleep, or I know that my nutritional needs are inadequate. Like they are recognizing that there is a shortfall, and they're question is about, won't this insert biohack here at least help me close the gap? And I feel like that's a legitimate question because these people are truly struggling.
So in those cases, it could, you know. So for example, someone who just like, if you have a child who will not eat certain types of foods, using vitamin supplements to plug those gaps, using maybe like a greens powder or some type of, you know, fruit and vegetable blend powder that they enjoy to fill those gaps, to provide some of those micronutrients. That's definitely, you know, that can go on a case by case basis. That's the challenge with, and you know this, like this is a challenge with communicating with large groups of people, is there's always exceptions to everything in an individual setting. But when we talk, the reason that I discourage some of this stuff when speaking to a larger group is because there's so many, if you're online and you're looking up Google search for anything related to health, fitness, running, anything, weightlifting, you are going to get bombarded with nonsense for the most part. Like you're most likely going to get ads for stuff you don't need. You're going to get suggested posts of things that are misinformation oftentimes, and that you have to really, you know, protect yourself against as best as you can. And that's the challenge when you're communicating with a large audience. I try to make people aware of that because that's most of what they see. And it's not that I don't think that sauna is useful sometimes. It's just that we need to really focus on where the main benefits can come from. And then in those specific cases, you have to learn how to make decisions, you know, on your own about, okay, you know, this is a scenario, or, you know, with working with someone and they help you kind of navigate some of that. But, you know, there are cases where certain supplements and things like that are helpful, necessary. But the challenge is that you have to understand the pros and cons of everything that you're doing. And when we're presented things, oftentimes we're given the pros and never the cons, and the pros are exaggerated. So we're getting like an exaggerated pros list, like with everything. Vegan diets, people are going to tell you, like Game Changers documentary, people say that it's, you know, the best thing ever for performance, blah, blah, blah. And then you hear people on the other side saying the same thing about carnivore. And nobody talks about the vegans who go vegan and they have B12 deficiency and or other deficiencies, zinc, and they start losing iron, they start losing their hair and having other health issues. Or on the other side, the carnivore individual who develops like inflammatory bowel disease or something like that over a year. These are very common. Like, these happen. I meet these people all the time, and we don't hear those sides of it. And it's really important that with the information, you know, in terms of nutrition, you know, sometimes these things are valuable, but it's making sure that you're making that decision with the right information and not because it was promoted to you in a very misleading way.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Something I find interesting about those types of communities, the carnivore community, the vegan community, whatever and there are a bunch of them, people who are adherents to this, that, or the other, is that so often if a member of the community is struggling with issues that could be related to practicing the thing, they're often told that they're just not doing it correctly, or they need to be more patient, or they just need to like keep going, instead of acknowledging, like you said, the cons or the you know, kind of obvious issues that some people might face. And I saw this all the time when I was in the low carb space. People were like really struggling, especially in performance oriented low carb spaces for endurance athletes, and people would just be really struggling, and they were told to put some butter in their coffee, yeah, or to just like up their electrolytes, or to just keep going, right? Like that, oh, you're just not doing it correctly. It's not the thing. It's you. You're the problem.
Your body hasn't adapted yet, or you have hidden seed oils. Like I'm in a couple low carb groups, and I see this stuff. It's always blaming the person rather than but this is the issue, is when you see that, that's a clear indication that this isn't about truth. This is about a belief system. Like, if it was about truth, there would be the people who would be there would be more inquisitive about what's going on, but they're there to prop up a belief system, not necessarily to understand the truth behind, you know, what might actually be happening. Yeah, I'm in a low carb group, and it's some of the most disturbing stuff I've ever seen. Like the responses that people get to certain things. Like, people have a LDL level of like 400, and this is like dangerous level stuff, and people will say, oh, it's fine, your HDL's, you know, not, your HDL's high and your triglycerides are low, so don't even worry about it. Like, this is misinformation, and these places turn into echo chambers, and that bothers me, because you know, I came at nutrition from a very scientific point of view, and never really, like, you know, when you're in an academic setting, like, people aren't like most of them. They aren't like, you know, low carb diet fanatics or, you know, everyone's trying to advance the understanding of nutrition. And when you get online, it just changes completely, where it's just diet tribes and trying to pull people into those things. And it's just important, you know, my goal is to really try to help build a platform educating and helping people understand things, rather than trying to shove a certain, you know, nutritional philosophy down people's throats. You know, everyone has their own reasons for eating various foods, and it's just important for people to just be aware and understand and have knowledge about the choices that they're making, as opposed to you know, trying to get everyone to eat a certain way.
I think an interesting example of how, you know, as new research comes out, the recommendations change, is recently when they've did a large scale study about intermittent fasting. I'm going to simplify this, and I'm sure you're much more familiar with the research than I am, but broadly speaking, they did a big study looking at intermittent fasting and changes in body composition. And they compared two groups of people who followed an intermittent fasting protocol and people who followed a, you know, non-intermittent fasting protocol. It was not time restricted eating, the same roughly caloric needs per day. And they found no changes in between the two groups in body composition. They both lost the same amount of weight. They both ended up in the same place. And basically, when intermittent fasting has been sold as this, like, you know, the perfect, the most amazing way to change your body composition, it's not really about the time restricted eating at all. It's about the total energy availability and energy in.
Exactly. The issue there is that a lot of the early studies with intermittent fasting, because the way that you first do studies is you'll run a study in smaller study, lower cost. So a lot of the early studies with intermittent fasting were just doing intermittent fasting compared to non-fasting, but they weren't controlling calories and they weren't feeding people. They weren't going through all that process because that's more expensive. So if you tell one group to fast and one group to not fast and you compare the two, the fasting group tends to do better because you're placing a dietary restriction upon them that limits their caloric intake in various parts of the day, which is going to limit their caloric or reduce their caloric intake overall. So that's where a lot of that initial, you know, excitement for intermittent fasting came from, is when you see these studies, it's like, oh, fasting is better than non-fasting because these fasting individuals lost more weight. The reality is it was just a restriction caused them to eat less. And now that there's more controlled studies, and this is the thing with science, is, you know, it develops, you know, so the problem is that when those first studies come out, people say, oh, fasting's better. Scientists weren't going in that, like, I was reading about fasting at that point, and I did plenty of fasting at that point too, but it was, or like, you know, 10 years ago when these studies first started being published and before these comparison studies were published. But as the science evolves, you know, these comparison studies consistently show that there's no difference. And it really just comes down to calorie intake. And there's some more recent evidence that may suggest that individuals who fast earlier earlier in the day, so they eat all their meals earlier and cut off their eating time at like 4 p.m.-ish, like some studies do 3, some studies do 4, some studies do 5, those show slightly greater fat loss than the other group, but it's marginal. Like, it's, you know, maybe a pound over a month or two, to where it wouldn't be something that would be noticeable and wouldn't be something that, like, for example, because I work with a lot of parents, you know, I wouldn't recommend a parent do that and then, like, just sit at dinner with their kids and family. You know what I mean? It's like, some of these things we have to look at from a scientific perspective, but then we also have to look at it from a practical perspective. And some of these studies have come out that have shown this mild benefit to getting your food earlier and cutting off, you know, your eating window earlier in the late afternoon / evening. But I haven't even really talked about that research, and I don't really recommend it that much because I don't want people to go out of their way for, like, you know, what would end up being some minor difference over a long period of time. And it requires such a change in your lifestyle. And this is the thing that sometimes gets lost in communication online is, you know, we'll talk about, oh, the study showed this, and then so someone wants to do it, but really taking it into context of like, okay, the study showed this benefit, but this benefit was really small, and is it really worth it? Like, instead of, you know, just being really sensational about it, really talking about the other side of it, like, is it really worth cutting off your eating window at 4 p.m. every day? You know, that may be worth it for someone who, you know, is really trying to optimize every part of their lifestyle, and they're single, don't have a family, things like that. Yeah, maybe it's worth it for that person. But for the majority of us, having dinner at 4 p.m. is just not practical. And we have to really take that into account and really take everything through that lens. Is this practical? Does it make sense? Because we could pile up a list of different things that have potential benefit from a health standpoint. You know, there's such a long list of things that might have a little bit of a benefit. You know, vinegar in meals, and eating protein before other meals might, you know, change glucose, glucose levels and things like that, where if we focus on so many things, it just becomes overwhelming. And really, nutrition, your exercise, it shouldn't be so overwhelming. This shouldn't be your whole life unless this is your job, like me. And then maybe it's acceptable. But, you know, I meet a lot of people who they're spending so much of their time, you know, trying to learn about every little, you know, detail about nutrition. And, you know, it's futile at the end of the day, because all these extra little changes are not really making that much of a difference. If you're focusing on the big picture and really getting these, you know, foundational principles in place, eating enough protein, fiber, eating the right amount of calories, eating plenty of plants, a variety of plants, things like that, you know, these other details aren't something that we really need to stress about too much.
I've had a lot of nutrition professionals on the show, PhDs and registered dietitians, and the general message I get from them is that most athletes, right, even those recreational, you know, among us, we exercise on purpose, we have performance goals, we're out there, you know, we're runners, we're triathletes, we're swimmers, whatever. Most people like us just aren't even eating enough, or eating enough of the right macronutrients at the right time. So to then try to restrict my eating window or add vinegar to a certain meal when I'm not even meeting my basic needs from an energy standpoint, that's like you're trying to build the top of the pyramid before you build the bottom of the pyramid. Like, it just, that's not going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's what, you know, that's what just tends to happen, because those things are it's exciting. Hearing about vinegar before a meal and that can have a massive impact on your health is more exciting than, like, you need to just eat more protein in your meals and have actual meals and not drink coffee for a meal. You know, these type of important things that a lot of people aren't doing, you know, those aren't as exciting. You know, telling people to eat three meals a day, that's been happening for 100 years. It's not nearly as exciting as, you know, some of these other things.
And it's also not making anybody money, right? That's always, who's getting paid? Mm-hmm. Who is, if are they presenting a problem and trying to sell you a solution at the same time?
Yeah, the glucose thing, that one's been really big, where people are wearing glucose monitors and things like that. That's a big, I mean, it's really interesting data, but at the end of the day, like, hyper-controlling glucose, like, it's just gonna be overwhelming, because then we have to look at triglycerides too, because triglycerides are important. Like, glucose is one risk factor among many, and people get really, really focused on this one risk factor and forget about everything else, and all these other risk factors are important. And if you're just trying to control glucose, oftentimes you're probably, like, for example, if you're eating less carbs and eating more fat, your glucose level will go down, but then your triglyceride level will go up, and that can have negative impact on health as well. I mean, it's just the way that these things are presented just tends to cause people to focus on the wrong things. And if you're just, like, you don't have to hyper control your glucose levels, if you're exercising on a regular basis and you're eating plenty of fiber, that's gonna that's going to cover most of it.
I often tell people that just because you can track it doesn't mean that it means anything.
That's
like,
really...
we can track, especially now, like the technology, there are so many things you can track. You can wear so many wearables that track different things. Like, just the amount of data that you have access to about your own body is unbelievable. But just because you can measure it doesn't mean that it, you need to do anything with that data.
That's a really good point. Same thing, microbiome tests. That's a really big one to use. There's a lot of people are selling these microbiome tests, and it's interesting data, but we really don't know how to make sense of this at this point, because the science on microbiome and in the gut and all these bacteria and how they impact our health is barely just starting to develop, and we don't understand it that well. It's gonna take 10 or 15 years of constant research on the microbiome to have a better understanding of what to do with that data, of like, how do we change the microbiome in a way that benefits people's health. We don't know how to do that at all right now.
I mean, there is evidence that you need a healthy microbiome for optimal health, but that sounds like everybody's might look a little bit different. Nobody quite knows what that actually
means.
Yeah,
and we don't know
means.
How to change it. Yeah, we don't know how, like, if I test your microbiome and I say, oh, it's unhealthy, how do I make it healthy? Like, a probiotic maybe might work, but that may not work with what your composition is, because everyone's is different. So you're talking with a probiotic, you're talking about putting in like 5 billion CFUs into a gut that has 40 trillion microbes. So it's a very small drop in a big pond of different microbes, and they all have different functions and they're doing different things. That probiotic may not have any impact. It may interact with those microbes in a positive way. It may interact with them in a negative way. Like, it's a complete guessing game right now in terms of how to modify the microbiome. Sometimes probiotics help people, but it's just completely hit or miss. Like, almost, it's a guessing game when it comes to the microbiome. And some people present it differently. Like, they say, you know, this supplement is going to heal your microbiome. And that's just not possible. We're just not there scientifically at all. Microbiome is really interesting, and I think that's like the next frontier of really making a massive impact, specifically on like autoimmune diseases and digestive issues. Like, once we know how to predictably change it, there's a lot of people who are dealing with, you know, chronic health issues that I think will be able to significantly benefit from that. But we're just unfortunately not there yet.
And there does appear to be a relationship between your microbiome and mental health, markers of mental health, brain health, neurotransmitters. That stuff's so cool.
Yeah. I mean, the microbiome, I mean, it impacts everything. So, like, I mean, it's just like anything else. It's like your metabolism affects every other part of your body. Same thing with the microbiome. It's just another kind of organ system. It's just an organ system that we didn't really even know existed, you know, 50 years ago, and we didn't know how to measure it. Like, the DNA-based stool tests that are now very popular, those barely got into like the scientific research community in like early 2000s. So we're talking about, like, we couldn't measure any of these microbes really, or most of them, until early 2000s. And then we first started doing a little bit of research on them from there. And now they're, you know, commercially available, but it's just, although 15 years sounds like a long time, or 20 years sounds like a long time from a scientific standpoint, like, that, because a lot of these studies take years to do, that's not a lot of time for the knowledge base in this specific area to develop. And so that's where, you know, even like gastroenterologists sometimes don't really have, don't provide patients with good guidance with regard to like microbiome and changes that can be made to improve it, because it's just still such a question mark overall.
And some of the best studies in different areas can take decades as they check in with the same population at different points, you know, throughout time. Those are very expensive studies to put on. Like you mentioned earlier, this is not like, the money has to come from somewhere. And I know every
researcher
is always...
Especially if you're doing stool tests. Like when, right? when you're collecting poop, it gets way more expensive. Like if you're doing, you know, thousands of people and tracking them over time and collecting poop, because of the transportation costs, the storage costs, the analysis costs, like that increases the cost of the study dramatically. So that's where this stuff just, you know, sometimes people think it's like a conspiracy that you know, pharma doesn't know how to change the microbiome, or like they're not telling us the solution or whatever. But it's just, this stuff moves slow. This stuff takes a lot of funding, and there's only so many scientists that can do this research, and those people are often, you know, they're working themselves to the bone oftentimes, doing different types of research studies and trying to advance the knowledge in different areas.
That's always a weird angle to me. I think that, you know, big pharma has a solution, they're just not telling us because it doesn't provide, you know, doesn't make them money. But then the person who is trying to sell you a solution is making money.
Yeah, the supplements, you know, like, and stuff.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. And it frustrates me because people say this all the time about nutrition research, is that it's funded by food companies and that type of thing. Like, having worked in that field for 5 years, like, nobody was funded by food companies. Like, every project that I worked on was funded by the National Institutes of Health, the American Heart Association, sometimes internal grants. Like, food companies didn't play a role in anything. And even when we were getting funded by National Institutes of Health, American Heart Association, these type of different organizations, they didn't have a role in what we did. And the scientists were doing it because they cared. Like, it's not just these people who, they're making not that much money. They're professors, they're teaching, they're doing research, they're making a modest living, and they're working to advance knowledge because they're passionate about a topic in almost every case. And I mean, in nutrition, I never met anyone who didn't fit that criteria who was doing like nutrition research. And I hear this dialogue online oftentimes, and it's used to try to discredit science in this topic, where people will say, you know, scientists are paid by food companies, and this is just so far from the truth. Now, the RD Association is the, I forget what it's called, American Academy of Dietetics or something, they changed it. ADA, I think is what it's called, Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, I think is what it's called now, actually. So that group is heavily funded by food companies, and they're the ones that offer the primary certification in nutrition. So sometimes people will use that story to kind of discredit these, you know, any people who are professionals in the space. But the reality is that's just the way it is. They're the ones that control the credential. They're heavily funded, but they control the credential. They don't have any impact on the actual universities and the teaching that goes on in the universities. They don't play a role in that. And the people who are working at the universities are generally passionate, smart, really well-meaning individuals who have no money, getting no money from food companies at all. Or Monsanto, because I hear that too.
Setting aside some of the, well, just for lack of a better term, call them biohacks, right? These little optimizations or shortcuts. Setting aside the ones that may genuinely have some value to some people in some situations, because some of them do, what are some fads or hacks that people have come to you with or asked you about, which you're just like, absolutely not, never in a million years, never, never, never?
Oh, man. One of them is the coffee enemas. Have you heard of that? Yeah, that's,
yes, I have.
That's pretty wild. So I've seen that before. I've met multiple people.
What's the benefit supposed to be? I don't understand. What are we getting, supposedly?
Liver detox.
Oh, right. That makes no sense.
Yeah, it's supposed to upregulate.
Colon's not a two-way street, people.
Yeah, upregulate glutathione 1,000% or something like that. I've heard so many claims around this. Yeah, I had a client that used to do it all the time, and I would try to convince her not to, and we had to stop working together. I'm like, you got to listen to me, I can't keep working with you with doing, you know, these type of things, because it's just dangerous. Like, you know, these. So that's a pretty extreme one. dry fasting. I've met people who do like not even water fast. So I've met people who are doing week long water fast. That like thinking that it was going to heal autoimmune disease, which there's not really any good evidence there, you know, at all. And you know, it's just dangerous. Like some of these things are dangerous. The detoxes, like the pills and powders, I've seen some extreme stuff where people are spending like $500 for a week of just a bunch of different powders, and it's just completely unnecessary. Like, but that's, you know, that's just some of the stuff that gets promoted online. But yeah, those, I think those are some of the like more extreme ones and more dangerous ones I've seen. To be honest, the carnivore diet right now, in my opinion, would be considered, I know there's some people who benefit digestive wise because there are people who have some degree of inflammatory bowel disease or some degree of intestinal inflammation who have a hard time with certain plant constituents. So like insoluble fiber, for example, the lectins in some cases, the gluten, some of these things can cause problems in certain people with underlying digestive issues. So I don't want to say, because I know people always come at me like, oh, I felt so much better and it healed my whatever. I know that there are very specific cases of people who feel better in the short term when they follow a carnivore diet. But overall, in my opinion, that's probably one of the most dangerous trends I've ever seen, like in my time working in this space, because I can't tell you how many, being in a couple low carb groups, I've seen so many people, and the ratio is high because I'm not in these massive groups, so like 6,000 or 7,000 people. And I see so many posts of people who had gallbladder issues, people who developed GI issues, people who developed heart issues, really, really high levels of LDL cholesterol. And that, in my opinion, is one of the most harmful ones because so many people are doing it. And it's really extreme. And it's something that if you asked me 10 years ago, I would have never possibly believed that this would be something that became a trend, that became almost normalized. Like someone eating only meat is almost a normal thing nowadays. Like that happened. Almost everyone knows someone who has tried or is currently doing a carnivore diet. And in the vast majority of cases, this is only going to cause harm. And it's not going to happen over the short term. A lot of people in the short term feel better because they lose some weight, they go into ketosis, so they feel good from the ketosis, and then they, you know, sometimes their digestion improves maybe because they're not eating any fiber, so the gas and the bloating that they may have had before with high fiber foods may be improved, so they're like, oh wow, this, you know, for every reason, this is great. But over the long term, not having those micronutrients from plants, not having any fiber, having that much saturated fat, that's not going to be, most likely not going to lead down the right path in terms of like chronic disease and longevity.
Setting aside the sustainability of eating like that for the rest of the many decades, hopefully, of your life, it's challenging when some of these, I don't even know what to call them, use carnivore as an example, that they are being promoted by people, very vocal public figures on the internet, who are seemingly like thriving for years and years at a time eating like this. And I can think of one very notable person who is very active on Twitter, who is like a hardcore carnivore adherent and talks about the ribeyes and like he's been eating this way for years and he's like jacked and has low body fat and you know, every kind of way of eating has their own kind of subset of like hardcore adherents who are very vocal about the thing. And I'm even thinking back to, you know, years ago on YouTube, Freely the Banana Girl.
Oh,
do you remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, like that was a big, for anybody who was not on YouTube, this has got to be like 10 years ago, she like only ate bananas, like hard, not even like regular vegan, like only fruit, like, you know, it's just, it is that belief system, right? So you see, that person is telling me that if they eat this way and they're experiencing these things, and if I eat this way, I will experience those things too.
Yep. And it doesn't always work that way. And if we look around and we use that as a way to make decisions about things, we're just going to be confused. Cause like you mentioned the banana girl, and when I was first getting into my PhD, the raw like vegan was kind of popular, and she was one of those. And so that's what everyone thought then. Oh, these people are so healthy. They're talking about, they healed these diseases or whatever. Oftentimes those stories are made up. Sometimes they're true. And sometimes they're because of a unique set of circumstances that happened with that individual. And that's the thing we have to understand, is just from a genetic standpoint, from a nutritional needs standpoint, from many different levels, we're all different. And there's, as I mentioned, there's some cases where some individuals do better on low levels of plant foods. But in general, all of the data that we have show positive effects of eating more plants, whether that be observational data, whether that be randomized controlled trials, when we feed people broccoli, or when we feed people nuts and seeds, when we feed people beans, when we feed people fruit, any type of plant food produces generally a negative or a positive effect on overall health and on various health markers, and that can't be argued with. Like, and so excluding those over the long term, we don't have data on that right now. So some of these people will say, you feel better, and they'll just kind of point people away from research, because all the research generally points to this pattern of eating is probably not going to be ideal in terms of cancer risk, in terms of heart disease risk. But we don't have that data because no one's ever only eaten meat. We don't have information on what happens over the long term. Maybe these people do this for 40 years and they thrive, and we develop this new data understanding how certain people can live off of this type of diet without any negative health outcomes. I don't think that's going to be the case though. I just being in the groups, I'm confident that most people will eventually develop health issues. The guy who wrote the book, The Carnivore Diet, The Carnivore Code, he's the one that popularized the whole thing. His book was all about only being a carnivore, and he's no longer a carnivore because he developed health issues. And now he promotes meat, fruit, rice, and honey. And he still calls himself a carnivore, though, because it's popular. It's so silly.
He's just moving the goalposts.
Exactly. I mean, and this is what comes down to kind of what we just talked about, is if you listen to his story, because I heard him early on a podcast, he had digestive issues or other health issues, and he took out all the plants and he felt better. So he didn't understand why he felt better. I could explain that. I could have said, hey, maybe you can just add these plants in and feel good, the diet that he's following now. But like so what he's following now is a low FODMAP diet. Like this is well understood to be, a beneficial approach for IBS. Like, and this is why taking a more scientific approach is important, because rather than avoid everything and just hope for the best, like you can actually learn more about, okay, I have IBS. What might be important for IBS? We know that a low FODMAP diet can be helpful. That is kind of what this guy's following now, and started with, the carnivore promotion, and led a lot of people down that path who probably also developed health issues as a result. So, these cases always exist on all sides of the spectrum. Again, it's the same thing with people who say, oh, I have a grandma who's 94 and smokes every day and drinks a bottle of Jack. Those we're all different. those cases do exist. Some of us can thrive. We're just lucky and end up thriving off of just whatever. But we have to use larger numbers. And that's why science is important. We have to use more data than just individual stories to gather a picture about what's really going on.
The plural of anecdote is not data.
Yeah.
And I will also say, I promise you that the whoever they are, the big shadowy they, is not like not doing the research on stuff like this for any ulterior motive. It's that ethically, you can't just make people do things to prove a point or to find like that's there's a whole ethics review that you have to go through, like many, many layers of proving that you're not going to intentionally hurt people or even like unintentionally hurt people when you're trying to do studies like this.
Yeah, no, they would not allow. So it would be really hard to get to put people on a carnivore diet and do a study on that. Like I couldn't imagine trying to get that through the internal review board at a university. They would push back because of, like you just mentioned, ethics. They would say, hey, this is potentially unsafe for some of these people. And yeah, that would be that study would be hard to do. It probably more requires the volunteers, like what they're doing now. And they're doing a really horrible study. So the carnivore community, they're doing like a online survey, and they're calling it a study where they're asking people to fill out a survey if they've done the carnivore diet for over 2 years, and they're publishing that that is evidence of the benefits of a carnivore diet. So they're trying to pretend like they're doing research on that end of things. And that's just what, I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about in terms of like the belief system of, you know, you got to be careful about getting sucked into these diet tribes where it's all about belief system, because they'll go to whatever means to uphold the belief. Their whole business and, you know, livelihood relies upon this diet oftentimes. Like if the carnivore guy, he still calls himself a carnivore because his whole business was built off being a carnivore. So like,
I mean, honey is technically made by bees. It's, I guess it's an animal product, right?
Yeah,
like, we really want to stretch.
But the fruit though, and the rice, like, I thought that was, cause I don't really, you know, people send me the stuff every once in a while, cause I get this stuff in my inbox, like, oh, can you please, you know, tell us why this is misinformation. And I just realized over time, because I heard him early on talking about the carnivore diet, and then I heard him talk about eating more stuff, and I was like, what happened there? And I looked it up, and it was like he developed health issues. And it's like, you, without turning around, like, you should turn around and make a PSA of like, hey, I need to retract my book. You know, everything that I'm putting out is potentially harming people, but the book is still selling, you know, and still telling people to eat only, you know, only carnivore. That's, it's just too many people are being harmed in this space. And, you know, sometimes people aren't being harmed, but, you know, oftentimes when people are falling for stuff, doing supplements, doing different diets, it may not outrightly harm you, but it's, you know, harming you secondhand in the time, energy, money that you're wasting, the false beliefs that you may, you know, kind of hold on to that may prevent you from actually doing what you need to be doing.
So the foundational components, where do you like to see people? What are the basic practices? You're like, forget the hacks. Here's what I recommend. If you're trying to optimize your health, these are the steps you need to be taking.
So first, have an understanding of your energy needs and how to meet them, especially if you have some weight to lose. Now, if you're naturally like just thin and you have no issue with like ever gaining any body fat, or, you know, you just stay at a good weight, then you don't have to. But if you go on the really thin side, or you go on the side where you hold on to some excess weight, understanding, you know, how many calories your body uses on a day-to-day basis and how to meet that amount, I think is really important. You know, a lot of times this is turns into some, you know, situation where people get a negative thought process of like counting calories or, you know, understanding this. But in my opinion, it's important. It's like having a gas gauge, you know, taking away the gas gauge on your car for a lot of people. A lot of people are trying to feed themselves. And as you mentioned earlier, I meet a lot of people who are just not eating enough, and then they're binging. Like, it's just chronically under eating and then binging on other times. So understanding your energy needs and then kind of figuring out how to meet those, like looking at, okay, what does that look like? What does a 2100 calorie day look like? How do I eat that much in a day? And then also meet other needs, which is, you know, protein. That's really important. So a lot of people ask me why I talk about protein so much, or why, you know, protein is important. So carbs and fat, they're mainly fuel. You know, fat is used for different, you know, structural components within the body, but for the most part, our carbs and fat are fuel. Protein is our structure. You know, those amino acids are used to rebuild tissue, to repair collagen, to repair all different, you know, aspects of our body, our structural tissue, our immune cells, our neurotransmitters. So it's important that we're eating enough protein. We don't have to overdo it and go into like bodybuilder zone where you're eating a pound per, you know, a gram per pound of body weight. But the average person in the United States is eating, like, male is like 90 something grams and female is like high 70s, like about 80 grams. That's too low. People are not eating enough protein overall. So, you know, focusing on making sure that you're getting enough protein. For most people, I typically recommend just eating 3 meals per day, and then maybe getting a snack in between there, but trying to focus on getting 3 solid meals per day, because too many people don't eat until lunch. They, you know, eat a meal and lunch and they binge on a bunch of snacks either before dinner or after dinner. And the reality is, like, they just needed another meal. So really trying to focus on getting 3 full meals per day so that you're fueled throughout the day, that you have energy throughout the day, and you're not, you know, binging in various times when you get access to certain foods. I think that's an important piece. Eating enough fiber is another, you know, foundational piece, in my opinion. This goes along with the next one, which is eating plenty of plant foods. So if you're eating plenty of plant foods, you're eating plenty of fiber. And this kind of ties along with, like, just eating mostly unprocessed foods, you know. So most people, I mentioned earlier, 60% of the diet is considered ultra processed foods. There's nothing, like, inherently wrong where if you eat a little bit of Doritos or Cheetos or whatever the case may be, like, it's just going to kill you. But we have to look at the ratio. If you're eating a ratio of foods that come from those categories where they're, you know, it's fat and sugar and refined flour, and there's added, you know, added preservatives and flavors and things like that, that needs to make up a smaller percentage of your diet, you know, 10-20%. Or, you know, depending on, you know, your own specific needs, maybe a little bit more if you're running a lot and you need those extra calories.
I was gonna say a little, like, I knew with our endurance athletes, yeah. We're not out there fueling our long runs with, like, lentils and mangoes, yeah, no, right? No. We're eating goo, we're eating mixes. Yeah.
In those cases, those processed foods serve a purpose in they're being utilized for more important reasons. But from an overall, like, health standpoint, you know, the vast majority of people are just not eating enough nuts and seeds, fruits and vegetables, you know, legumes, lentils, things like that. So just making sure that we're having enough processed or unprocessed foods, making sure that we're eating plenty of plants, plenty of fiber, and trying to get a variety there. So, you know, there's different potential health benefits from different, it mostly coincides with color, but different types of plant foods. So for example, like blueberries and cherries, they all have, and grapes, they all have what are called polyphenols, and so these specific types of micronutrients might have more, like, heart health benefits. And then we have, like, the red from tomatoes, the lycopene in tomatoes seems to be beneficial for, like, cancer risk. So eating a variety of different plant foods, you know, some green, some red, some blue, some white, you know, just having a variety of that seems to be beneficial from a health standpoint in terms of disease risk, and then from a microbiome standpoint, in terms of giving our gut access to a variety of different fiber sources. Because every type of food has its own unique fiber source or fiber makeup. So a lot of people think fiber is soluble, unsoluble. Well, fiber is really the fiber that broccoli has and the fiber that beans have, and they all have different structures, and they all feed our microbiome and have different microbes that can use that fiber and access that fiber. And so the more types of fiber that we eat, the more diversity that it promotes in our microbiome, which seems to be a good thing. So that I recommend, those are, like, kind of the main overarching things: fiber, plant, variety, making sure that you're eating the right amount of calories, and then, you know, the right amount of protein. And if you're focusing on those things overall, like as overarching principles, you know, I think that's mostly what I focus on. Like, I don't, you know, I've been doing this my whole life, essentially. Like, I'm 35 now. It's been 17 years of started eating healthier, you know, when I was 18 years old, started exercising at that point. You know, I did a lot of fads in my early 20s, but by 26, 27, just been eating a balanced diet, not focusing on too much, trying to eliminate too much. And I you know, anecdote aside, I feel great and have, you know, just, you know, it's easier than what I was doing in my early 20s, because in my early 20s, I was doing all the fad stuff because I didn't, you know, I got online and started reading stuff, and I was like, oh, let me go vegan. Let me do this. Let me try this. And, you know, it's just, if you're focusing on these major, large, you know, things that matter, you have an understanding of your energy needs. You're eating plenty of, you know, micronutrients from various different types of plant sources. You're including plenty of protein, plenty of fiber. Like, those are the things that are going to make the biggest difference for most people. For individuals, there may be small things that need to be adjusted from there, but those overarching principles for most people are going to have the largest long-term health impact.
I'll say, if you can stay hydrated and get enough sleep as well, you're like 99% of the way there.
I was going to say hydration, but I was thinking about just nutrition. And then, yeah, sleep would definitely be, well, sleep and exercise. We got to talk about all types of exercise, running and
my listeners typically have no problem getting enough exercise for the most part.
For sure. But yeah, the sleep, the hydration, definitely important. But yeah, from the nutritional standpoint, that's typically what I have anyone that I work with. We're just really focusing on how to do that in a way that is just sustainable for them. And the beautiful thing is that looks different for everyone. You know, that's going to look completely different for one person than the other, but those underlying principles are still the same, and they still apply in almost every case.
And I know that the nutrition piece for a lot of people, we talked about in the show a lot, that is something that feels like the big mystery. Because even though they may understand, well, I, you know, I heard it from Dr. Chavez and I heard it from this dietitian, like everybody is telling me the same things, but I'm having trouble applying it to my own life. That's how working with somebody can be really beneficial, right? Whether it's a run coach or a qualified nutrition professional or whoever it is that's going to help you figure out how it works for you. That's okay, right? That's the next step. Hopefully you get to do it once and you never have to do it again, because you'll learn what you need for your body.
So I mean, I know some people probably think, oh yeah, this person, because he works with people, that's why he's saying this, but I'm not saying this from this standpoint at all, but this is probably the best investment that most people can make who are thinking about nutrition, who are, you know, going out, buying supplements, things like that. Like, if you invest in working with a good coach for a short period of time, they should educate you to the point where you feel confident with your own nutrition from there forward, and you have a plan that you can stick to, that you can maintain, and that you save money on and time and energy on all of this other stuff. Yeah, I mean, I see it all the time in clients that I work with and people who work with other individuals as well. It's a fast track to really, because otherwise you're, in most cases, it's going to be months, if not years, of, do I do this? Do I do that? You do this for, you know, a short period of time, but then you question it. That's the biggest thing, I think, for a lot of people, is you question yourself a lot because you don't have the confidence in, like, knowing that this is going to produce an outcome. Whereas if you work with a coach who's experienced, who knows what they're talking about, and you know, has experience with your specific, you know, what you're going through, they can provide you a lot of certainty in saying, okay, you just have to stick with it. You have to be patient, because that's the challenge for most of us, is we start it, and then when we don't see the results after a couple of weeks, you know, we want to see what the next thing is and what's going to get us those results in that short period of time. But yeah, I completely agree. I think most people, I mean, I do this occasionally, this poll on my Instagram, where I'll ask, like, how much people have spent on supplements or something along those lines, to, and then how much they've spent on, like, working with a dietitian or a nutritionist. And it's always substantially more. Like, people have spent substantially more on biohacks as opposed to on getting actual education and you know, developing some foundational skills around this topic.
Thank you so much for being here today. This is a great conversation to have. I know a lot of the stuff that we talk about in the show is very hyper-specific to like adult recreational endurance runners. And I often kind of try to extrapolate out about like general health, general well-being, general like just try to be a healthy person. And I love that this conversation has added to that and hopefully maybe helped people understand or think more critically about where the sources of information that they're getting in their lives, are they belief system or are they, you know, research backed? Let's just put it that way. This is what you do. This is your job, like you said, and you have your own podcast. So tell our listeners how people can learn more about you if they want to learn about any of these topics in depth, if they want to work with you one-on-one or in a group setting. Tell us more about yourself.
Yeah, so my podcast is called the Nutrition Science Podcast, and so that is, I just relaunched it. I ran a podcast a while back, but it was COVID kind of got in the way of things, so I didn't do it for a couple of years, but just relaunched that. Instagram is the best place to find me in terms of content. My Instagram is @dr.adrian.chavez. I'm sure you'll put the link in the show notes. But yeah, you can find me there. And that's a good place to, and I have, if you go to the link through Instagram, you can find all different resources, how to work with me, programs, courses, things like that. But yeah, that's, you know, that's the best place. And that's where I kind of do the most of my educating is through the podcast and through Instagram.
And your Instagram is wonderful.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you being here today.
Yeah, thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Don't forget, you can always find and follow me on Instagram @runningexplained. And if you're looking for a coach or a training plan, check me out. Visit my website, runningexplained.co. That's runningexplained.co. See you next time. This content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you have regarding a medical condition.